Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. In studio with us this week is Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski, and we're going to have a conversation with him that we hope includes your calls and emails. You can dial in at 496-1999. You can send those emails to ask@wbaa.org. You can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, let's start with a fun question, Mr. Mayor. And I love the specificity that Tom has written in with here. And he wants to know when the city will please reposition the sundial on the Myers Pedestrian Bridge. He says it's been out of whack for like 10 years. And you were telling me before the show this is something that you've tried to get the city engineer to work on once the bridge is finally back up and running.
Yeah. Well, let's first keep the humor in it. Talking about the bridge is not fun right now.
I suppose not.
But we are getting ready to hopefully in the next week or so to start putting up the rail. But yes, that gentleman contacted me a while back and then sent me some documentation on how the sundial should be positioned. In fact, I'm not sure it's ever been totally positioned correctly at the right angles at the right time of day to make all that work. Maybe since it's been placed there. I'm not sure. So that's something that I have forwarded to the city engineer, and we're going to look at it. We've got some other issues that are a little bit more pressing there right now that we're working on with the railing that you and I have discussed in the past, and some other things that we really need to get done to get the bridge open and get it accessible for people. And we're also starting that second ramp project. But the sundial is certainly on our radar.
What is the latest on getting those railings installed?
I'm hoping that maybe a little bit quicker than we thought, that maybe here in the next week, maybe next week even, we'd start to see some of those railing pieces come in, and we get some of that put together. We're trying to time it now with the flagging that's required by the railroad to have that railing in, get some of that ramp started. We're also taking down one staircase that comes down the backside of the plaza there. It's a maintenance monster for us. And with all the improvements that we've done, you would have a ramp, you'd have an elevator, and you'd have a set of stairs and a ramp on the other side. So we think that additional set of stairs is really redundant for access down to the platform. And it's made out of metal, and it's really requires a lot of maintenance. So we're going to take that down. So we're trying to time it now to kind of do all of those at the exact same time while the railroad flaggers are there.
Speaking of getting people down to that platform, it's been brought to the attention of people that there have been actually fewer trains than have been expected to get people down to that platform, and there have been more buses being taken. Mm-hmm. Are you disappointed in some ways at how Iowa Pacific has handled the Amtrak service thus far?
Well, I mean, you're always disappointed when there are delays and setbacks like that. I think that's normal. But I certainly haven't lost confidence or lost hope in the ability of Iowa Pacific to effectively run the train. You know, they're getting ready to add some cars in the business class cars. There has been days when, before that happened, when the train's been on time. In fact, I was with Representative Truitt last week over here at Purdue at a group with some PhD students talking about the Hoosier State and trying to gather some data and help us look forward into the future with a project that they were doing involving transportation. And Randy said that he had rode the train, I think maybe the week before, maybe a couple weeks, I don't recall exactly, and it was actually 45 minutes early and had a great experience. So I really do think the capacity is there, the opportunities are there. We're still very early into this, but I'm still, optimistic that we're going to make this work.
On another transportation matter, I want to get to a question that came in to us before today's program. Someone wrote in and wanted to know about the intersection of State Road 26 and U.S. 52 in Lafayette. They say that when traveling westbound on 26 after crossing Earl Avenue, there's often a traffic blockage that happens there. Someone needs to turn left onto 30th or 31st Street, and there's no left turn lane there, they say. So there's, one lane for westbound, two lane for eastbound traffic, and becomes blocked during rush hour. I've gone through there during that time. I'm sure you have, too. This person says, it can back up. It can inhibit the flow through the intersection. Can be dangerous for people who have, just had near misses on accidents near that 5226 interchange. They want to know, can traffic lanes be repainted? Are there other solutions possible there? What are your thoughts?
Well, there's a couple things in play right now. Obviously, when you're going westbound on well, technically South Street now. There's a conveyance of traffic there because when you turn right, and we can't get as many people through onto 52 because of the construction. So we have more people going straight because they can't turn right, and traffic backs up there more than normal, and particularly at rush hour. The other issue is that, and some of it will be alleviated with the next phase of the project, but not all of it. As you pass Steak and Shake there, and those lanes then condense as you approach Earl Avenue, you know, that becomes back to more of a city street type size. The only way to really change that, if you were going to create what's called a Super 2 with dual left turns and right turns at certain spots, you know, you'd have to widen the road significantly. And, of course, then most of the people that live along that stretch of South Street there would lose the vast majority of their front yards by the time you widened the road, put in left turn lanes, put the sidewalks back in, the 4-foot planting barriers and things like that. So, you know, that's really what would be required to alleviate some of that problem, is actually widening that road right there. The good thing that will happen when we do the middle section of Sagamore Parkway, what we're hoping, we're in negotiations with folks right now to acquire some land at the intersection of 52 and South Street, so we can at least widen the intersection from Earl Avenue up to 52. And if we can do that and create some additional capacity with the right turn, a straight, and a left going westbound and going eastbound, we'd like to have two straights, a left, and a dedicated right. I think we can alleviate some of that. Will that ever get perfect right there during rush hour without actually widening that road, that section of South Street from Earl Avenue up to about 26th Street, widen that whole section there, because there's a lot of cross streets in there where people make turns? That would be the only way to fully remove that.
So you've got right there, I've gone through this intersection a number of times, you've got a median in the middle of after you turn left to head west on South Street, there's a little bit of a median there that separates the eastbound and the westbound lanes. Are you talking about things like getting rid of that to give yourself some more space to widen it?
Well, we're actually talking to some of the property owners along that section to see if they would be willing to either sell right away, sell some additional property, maybe sell their property, where in that section between on South Street between Earl and 52, we would widen that spot significantly, and we'd create a lot of lanes for different movements, which would hopefully, if you can separate everybody left, right, left turn, straight, and right, it can keep traffic moving through there much more smoothly. You get more people through each light cycle.
Well, let me ask you about the light cycles for a second, because that's a thing that's common, I think, at a lot of intersections along Sagamore Parkway through Lafayette, is if you're on 52, you get a much longer time to get through those intersections, mm-hmm. which makes sense because there's a much higher volume of traffic on those roads than on the arterial streets. But could you, by even just changing it a couple of seconds, the turn arrows or things like that, could you go even further in alleviating some of these traffic concerns if you change the timing of the lights as it respects the roads that come off of 52?
Well, I mean, that's every time you make some adjustment, some other movement gets less time, right? There's 60 seconds in a minute. So you've got, you know, if you have a 60-second cycle, a 2-minute cycle, or a 3-minute cycle on some of the big intersections, by the time you do protected lefts and straights, you know, that you can have close to 3 minutes. It just depends. I mean, we cannot stop people from, you know, if we do that, maybe we back people up that can't get that left turn made off of 52 to go eastbound on 26 at certain times of the day, or people going westbound that make a left turn onto 52 off of 26 to go south on 52. So, you know, those are things that we always monitor. The good thing, once 52 is all done, all those those lights will be the city of Lafayette's now. They'll all be on our system. They'll all be connected by fiber optics, and they'll all be part of our traffic management system that we use now, that we literally in real time can sit there and watch that and see if there are, you know, small tweaks that we can make that would improve that. So when the project's all done, we will have that capacity to monitor and to regulate, and literally with some clicks of a computer screen, make adjustments if necessary. And so it's something that we'll monitor. We don't have that. With everything tore up, obviously, and everything going on, we don't have that capacity right now.
Causes me to think about something else that seems to be, bigger in Lafayette than I've seen it in other places. And that is, especially as you get from downtown out to about 52, there's a lot of no turn on red signs, be it right or left. And I can't help but wonder if that gums up traffic. It seems to me, and I'm not a traffic engineer, but it seems to me there are a number of intersections where those are superfluous, where you could perfectly safely make a right turn on red into the flow of traffic, especially. And so I wonder if there's a way to go back and take a look at maybe each one of those signs and go, do we really need this?
Yeah, I mean, we're always open to continuing evaluation. And if people have areas where they think that's the case, let us know. I mean, we'll certainly continue to look at it. It depends, again, on the cycle of the intersection. Sometimes what happens, we end up putting those up because people forget about the protected left. So they pull up, they look to their left to make a right turn on red, and they forget that traffic across has got a protected left that starts to turn, and they don't even think about that car coming, and we have accidents. And so there's ones where we've discontinued the right turn on red because the protected left is a pretty heavy intersection and it causes accidents and things like that. But we're always open to reevaluating the intersection and do what's good for traffic flow and what's good for safety.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Our guest today is Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski, and you can send your questions in by calling us at 496-1999. Send an email to ask@WBAA.org or tweet questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Another question came in from Kathy, who wrote in wanting to know about solutions to gun violence. And she says, I'd like to know if Lafayette or West Lafayette or the county have any kind of committee or task force, especially one with citizen involvement, to address gun violence. She says the Purdue campus was touched by this issue, and I was concerned this summer when there were 3 incidents in 2 weeks involving guns near my house on Erie Street. One of my neighbors had a bullet go through her house, she says. And so Kathy wants to know about ways to try to solve that.
Well, I mean, the departments work together all the time. And so if there's a specific task force on gun violence, there is not. I mean, obviously we have the Mothers That Demand Action group here in the community that's been action before on gun violence and looking at getting legislation pushed through that deal with gun violence. We've said in our press conference that we had a while back and what we're really working on and with yesterday with the Drug-Free Coalition, the panel discussion that took place at City Hall regarding heroin and drug issues and addiction. We know that the vast majority of our crime, of those types of incidents, are drug-related in some way. We estimate that of our more violent type crime, it's well up into the mid-90s, and even our property type crime is into the 80s. And so you combine those two, it's an overwhelming majority of crime, and particularly violent crime, that's related to drug use, drug deals, somebody stealing from somebody else that got drugs, or stealing or committing a robbery to fuel their habit. And so,
let me expand Kathy's question for a second. Is there a gun violence group, and is there a drug crime group that citizens like her could be involved with?
Well, yeah, there's the Drug-Free Coalition of Tippecanoe County. They've been in existence for a long time. They have a board, and they sponsored the event yesterday. They work on legislation. So there is a group that people can get involved with. And, of course, on the law enforcement side, we have the Tippecanoe County Drug Task Force and the street crimes units and the different groups that work that. But, yes, there's been in existence for many, many years, the Drug-Free Coalition of Tippecanoe County. They sponsor the Red Ribbon Breakfast and those activities during the month of that they do those. And so, there's great. There are ways to certainly get involved and have your voice heard. And I think more and more people are trying to with the onset of heroin and opioids. And I don't know, if you heard some of the data yesterday on throughout the United States and in the state of Indiana, the information is staggering on the number of people. How many painkillers are prescribed to people? The United States consumes 80% of all pain medication in the entire world. And Indiana's ranking is very high also. And so there's a lot of different issues we're going to look at, from treatment to law enforcement to how prescription medication for pain medicine is prescribed. You know, there's a good panel yesterday of people from that, from the ER doctors in the emergency room to the prosecutor to the police to people involved with treatment. It was a good crowd at City Hall and the council chambers. And I think the discussions are very good, and they're critical to helping solve the problem.
You mentioned the press conference a couple of weeks ago where your street crimes unit and others said, hey, we're going to do some things. We're going to let more officers take their cars home so there's some more visibility in neighborhoods. We're going to ask the public for some more help from them in terms of getting involved. I have to ask, and forgive me if this sounds cynical, but you and I talked on this program a couple of months ago about whether there's an increase in crime and whether what I've been hearing from people like Kathy, it denotes something that the city needs to work on. Is that press conference an admission that that's going on and that much more needs to be done to try to address a rise in crime in Lafayette?
Well, I mean, like we said that day, what we've always said, you know, we continue to see the rise in the use of methamphetamines. Spice, you know, Spice has really taken off, and as we heard yesterday, they're lacing it with all kinds of different things. And then with heroin, those drug crimes continue to grow. So it's not a spike in crime where we know if we arrest two or three people, you know, the burglaries are all going to go down, or if we do this, the armed robberies are all going to go down. We know that because the data is indisputable. We just keep looking at it, and we've been talking about these changes for months as we approach the 2016 budget cycle to be able to do that. And so we know that this drug problem is not going to go away on its own, and therefore the rise in crime is not going to go away just by using what might be called traditional law enforcement tactics and procedures. And we're going to have to do some things differently, some things we'll work with the legislator to try to get more treatment, to get more detox facilities. The chief said we can't arrest our way out of this. You cannot arrest your way out of this problem. But we do have to make sure that the law enforcement side of it is doing everything they can to be part of the solution. The take-home vehicles, that does help with visibility. There's a lot of studies out there that it does help promote relationships in the neighborhood. The policemen have all their gear with them if they need to respond to something. And so,
let me ask one quick question about that. Do the police officers live in the areas where you're having the biggest problems? In other words, are you sending those cars home with officers and they live in these kind of sketchy places where you might be seeing, you draw a circle around it on the map and go, all right, here's the place we need to really address? Or are they going home to, frankly, nicer areas where there isn't as much crime?
Well, I mean, we have officers that live in all different types of neighborhoods, and I don't like to use, with all due respect to you, I don't like to use the term sketchy. There are no bad neighborhoods. There are great people and great neighborhoods that have certain people and certain activity in them that is unacceptable and criminal that we need to deal with. But on the other hand, when people commit some of those crimes, they're not committing all of those just in their neighborhood. VPs are located all over the city, all over different types of main routes throughout the city, and that's one of the main things that get robbed. Some of these other crimes that occur are not just all in specific neighborhoods, and unfortunately they spill over sometimes out into main thoroughfares of traffic and different things like that. So I think the take-home car program has proved and will prove to be a help. It's not, you know, it's not a magic wand that all of a sudden makes everything better, but I do think it has value. I think it's good for morale on the police department, and I think it's certainly a step in the right direction. And regardless of wherever you live, you have to drive through places to get home also, back to where you live. And so all these people will be living in the city limits of Lafayette, and so I think that that will have an impact.
We've got just a few more minutes with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rzeworski on today's Ask the Mayor program here on WBAA. You can send questions to ask@WBAA.org from your email address. You can also tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. Tim has written in and says, street striping and painted arrows in Lafayette are pretty visible, except at the gray times of dawn and dusk and after sundown and whenever it's raining. He says, does the city and the state have a timetable to paint those sometime soon?
Yeah, our painting should start. We've already approved the contract. I would think that the crews would be here. We contract that out. The city's large enough now. We just don't have the equipment and the manpower to get the city painted, and you don't want to hire so many people that you can do it, and then you don't have them anything for them to do during the winter. So we contract that out every year. It's about $80,000 contract. I think the crews are supposed to be here, maybe even yet this week or next week to start doing our painting. But we actually do a contract every year for street striping. The roads that get repaved, that goes in that contract, but then we do this separate one that I'm talking about where we have them come up and touch up everything else. And we'll continue to do that. It's a challenge. I would prefer to be able to do that sometime in the spring. I think people would notice it more if we touched them up in the spring as opposed to going into winter. But we have a very aggressive crack sealing program. We try to crack seal several miles of roads each year to make them last as long as possible. And we've got to get that crack sealing all done before they come back in and paint the lines, or we'd be crack sealing over brand new lines. And so we're going to kind of try to tweak some of that timing and see if so it's a little bit more noticeable to folks. But we do every year anywhere from a high 60s to the low 80s, depending on exactly how much we think we can get done. We put out a pretty significant contract each year for road painting.
Regarding fixing roads, it occurs to me to ask you, since you guys have been working with the state on 52 and some other projects, what did you make of the recent worries coming out of NDOT that some of the asphalt that they had been contracting out to other contractors is not lasting anywhere near as long as they thought it would? Did that cause you to go back and look at the projects that you guys have partnered with NDOT on and go, hey, is that a possibility here?
Well, I mean, you always want to evaluate that. And I'm, you know, I think it's a good idea that NDOT is looking into that. I think it's important that we continue to have those checks and balances. And obviously NDOT, because they do millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of work, they kind of have the stature to be able to look into something like that and to see if there's a problem. So I think it is good that they're looking into it. I think we need to have those discussions. We're fortunate where I don't see where we have anything that's related to asphalt that's caused us a problem yet. We had some sub-base issues, but not asphalt. But I would like to see it looked into. I've said, you know, asphalt's really a byproduct, and as they learn to take more oil out of it, it does seem that, maybe it cracks a little easier. We haven't had total failures like they're having, but I think having those checks and balances in place is important.
Just in our last couple of minutes, let's see if we can get through a couple of questions about
sure.
What's been the big news of this last week, I think, around here, which has been the announcement that a baseball team coming back to Loeb Stadium in Columbian Park. Tell me about how the conversations you had with city officials were in terms of loosening the restriction that you couldn't have alcohol in a city park, because that was a big factor, maybe the deciding factor in this sports marketing firm, which owns the team, deciding whether they were going to put a team here.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big part of it. And, you know, that kind of stopped the success of the Lafayette Leopards years ago. And so, you know, those discussions were as we really evaluated the impact that a team could have on the community, what it would mean for Columbian Park, what it would mean for Loeb Stadium in its current condition, and what it might mean going forward when we look at a new stadium and what other uses we might be able to put in there, such as soccer. And MKE Sports is actually MKE Entertainment, so they do a lot of different things also. And, you know, we really thought the value and the pros outweighed the con. They've got a very good track record of how they conduct themselves, how they handle their alcohol sales, how they use police officers for security. And we really felt that the pros outweighed the negative. I think it's going to be a great family-friendly entertainment. They do a lot of neat things with the kids out on the field and different events during the games. And I think it's going to be a positive. It's not a decision, as a former police officer and stuff, it's not a decision that we took lightly, but it's one that we think has benefit. And when, you know, a lot of people take their kids to golf outings and to Cubs games and Indians games and Colts games and different activities. And I think it's important that, you know, all of us, and that we teach our children, because there is going to be alcohol around, to do things in moderation, to make good decisions. And I think we can all help set that example. And I think it'll be fine. And it's we're looking forward to some great rivalries with Kokomo, and you know, having a team that the community can really get behind.
Can you tell me a little bit about the lease terms? I mean, I'm curious, especially who makes money on what. What does the city make revenue on, and what does the ownership firm make money on?
Well, the city's not going to really make a lot, really much money on anything these first couple years. As you know, Loeb Stadium is up for a significant renovation, so it has its limitations on what can be done there. MKE Sports is going to invest several thousands of dollars of doing some of their own improvements and creating space for some activities and special concessions that we don't have. The lease agreement's for $7,500 for the season. I think there's 30 home games that they would have there.
How long is the agreement, by the way? Just for the 1 year or going forward?
Well, there's options in it that it can be renewed, but everybody knows that once we get to the new stadium piece, then the lease would change substantially. You know, they're going to furnish, we're going to have people out there working on the fields and stuff, but when they're doing the fields, getting ready for their game, then they're going to pay their salary for us for the time that they spent working on the field. So, you know, the city's not going to make a lot of money off of it right now, and that's fine. I mean, the $7,500 more than covers our expenses for having the lights on and things like that. But what's really important is here is getting the team in here, getting that relationship built with MKE, getting the relationship built with the city and the team, and then really look to that next step of a new stadium and what that agreement and the different opportunities and the other events and things that might be able to take place there on a field that's turf. I think that's really what we're looking forward to, is how this might look in the future. But right now, we just...
Let me ask you a little bit about that, because you've mentioned this possibility of the new stadium a couple of times. It sounds like you view at some point a multi-use venue going forward. And the question I would have is, where does the money come to create such a thing?
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely looking at a multi-use, where we'd have turf, where you would be able to do different types of tournaments, because you wouldn't have to worry about ruining the grass. The turf would be able to hold up. We'd like to see soccer. You probably saw where Kokomo's now got a soccer in there. We'd also like to see some other potential venues. So, you know, we'll look at our budgets within the city, within our TIF district, and within our budget to make it a reality. So we'll do it within our normal budget cycles.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time. We appreciate it, and we'll do it again next month.
Right. Thanks, Stan.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember, all these programs are archived at our website, WBAA.org. Tune in next week for our conversation with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Have a good rest of your day.
Support for Ask the Mayor on WBAA comes from your membership and Butler, Fairman & Seifert, a civil engineering firm providing communities with professional expertise and guidance. Butler, Fairman & Seifert, civil engineering solutions for better communities. BFSENGR.com.